Good afternoon, everybody, and welcome to this webinar on the NROADS Research Project Evaluation Readiness, Program Quality and Outcomes in Men's Behaviour Change Program. I'm Paul Monsor, Secretary of Services and Practitioners for the Elimination of Abuse Queensland, otherwise known as the Speak Network, and I'll be your host for this webinar. This webinar is a first for both Speak and the newly named Workforce Development Service WorkUp Queensland. We're pleased to be able to present this webinar addressing what I believe is core business for men's domestic violence behaviour change programs, all about program outcomes, evaluation and improving program quality. Our presenters today each have a long history of involvement in research, policy and practice in men's behaviour change programs and bring a great depth of knowledge to the subject. This particular piece of research was completed at the end of 2018. Several of the recommendations have directly informed a quality framework for intervention programs, soon to receive final approval within the Department of Child Safety, Youth and Women. It also has much broader applicability. Webinars divide into four sections, and they cover the four main themes within the research. In each section, there'll be a presentation of around about 10 minutes, and then around about 10 minutes for Q&A. You're strongly encouraged to ask questions by either the Zoom chat function or audio. The instructions have been emailed to you this morning and are also on the Speak website, accessible from the public events page or speak.org.au/webinar. I'll now introduce our presenters. Rodney Blaise, consultant from Melbourne. Rodney, you want to say hello?
Hello, everybody.
Professor Andrew Day from University of Melbourne.
Hi, everyone.
And Professor Donna Chung from Curtin University in Perth.
Hi, folks.
And now over to you, Rodney.
Right. Thank you, Paul, and hello, everyone. I'll be starting off the first segment, introducing the research and focusing particularly on what the research told us about minimum standards and compliance with minimum standards for men's behaviour change programs. So as Paul mentioned, I'll start off with some slides. I'll be going through the slides really quickly for about 8 to 10 minutes, and then there'll be an opportunity for questions. So I'll put the slideshow up now. Right, so everybody should now be able to see the slideshow. So as Paul mentioned, three of us as research contributors are here today. We have Donna Chung, the bass player there, who will be talking very soon, looking at victim survivor women's perspectives in the research. The research team was led by Andrew from James Cook University then, and also University of Melbourne now, who will be talking third, looking at research, the evaluation, what it means for outcome measures, and investigating effectiveness. Damien Green, unfortunately, can't make it for today. He was also with Curtin University, and there is myself as well. So why this research study? I think one of the things we're all grappling with is how do we improve the effectiveness of men's behaviour change programs? And this was one of a number of wide-reaching research studies that NROADS funded to try to see how we can improve effectiveness. You know, we know that the current state of knowledge of the effectiveness of men's behaviour change programs, you know, is uneven. You know, some studies show some evidence of effectiveness in some situations. There are a number of studies that don't. We're all aware of the methodological problems and the major things that plague this research to work out, you know, is the work that we do effective? So the research involved a number of components. It included a literature review, a scoping review, looking at what does the current state of evidence say about the effectiveness of men's behaviour change programs. We did a jurisdictional scan, looking at jurisdictions both within Australia but also overseas, in particular focusing on their systems for setting minimum standards, for promoting and improving quality of the work, for monitoring compliance with the standards by Men's Behaviour Change Program providers, and what they do to help to equip and train workforces. And I'll be spending part of my time talking about that. There was a qualitative in-depth research with victims and survivors with women who their partners have participated in men's behaviour change programs. We did focus group research with practitioners as well, and we drew all of those components together to focus on our recommendations and findings, which we'll summarise towards the end. So firstly, if we look at minimum standards, and as mentioned before, we'll take quite a quick fly through these slides because, like a number of the ANRO studies in the perpetrator intervention research stream, we covered quite a lot. We see in Australia that I think probably about five out of the eight Australian jurisdictions now have set minimum standards to some extent. And in other English-speaking countries, minimum standards are a very common aspect of providing men's behaviour change programs, domestic violence perpetrator programs, battery intervention programs, whatever we call that. One of the things that our research found is that these minimum standards by large have been set out of historical precedents of what's considered good practice by practitioners and understandable, you know, concerns about what unsafe and inappropriate practice might mean, coming from specialist women's service providers and coming from people who are doing the work. And we found, of course, that has inputted in, you know, really important momentum into the standards. We also found, however, that the evidence base for a number of the standards in terms of what the literature says is just really non-existent. And so that many of the minimum standards focus on that practitioner-based wisdom rather than being based on a literature evidence-based. One of the things as we looked at different sets of minimum standards around the world is that difference between some minimum standards approaches, which were based mostly on principles. The minimum standard sets were smaller, they were bigger picture, they were higher order, and focused mainly on the intent of particular standards rather than taking deep dives into the detail. And then there are other sets of minimum standards that did have a much more detailed prescriptive approach. It was one of the major differences that we found across different sets of standards. And of course, one of the big issues here is the compliance with minimum standards. How do we promote and promote compliance with the standards themselves? And one of the things that we increasingly found here, particularly in Australia, but also in the UK, is that if we look at perpetrator interventions more generally, while men's behaviour change programs are, of course, always an important part of options that are available, we are seeing innovations in working with people who cause family violence harm that don't fit the traditional box of either a corrections or a community-based men's behaviour change program. You know, whether it be programs working with adolescents who are using violence in the family home, whether it be looking at interventions with particular cultural communities or case management interventions, or post-program work to try to keep the work alive for men who have completed a program. Programs run by Aboriginal community-controlled organisations. These all don't necessarily fit a men's behaviour change program box. So how do the standards speak to them and not only to traditional men's behaviour change programs when we have this spirit of innovation? One of the other complexities here too is that the spectrum of perpetrator interventions, including front-end work with men who might be referred by police, where services might be attempting to do that really, you could say, assertive outreach work with men, telephone-based work with men sometimes, or case management work with men who may not yet have the capacity or readiness to participate in the deeper perpetrator intervention. So how do standards speak to them? How do standards speak to one-to-one work with men who may not be ready for a men's behaviour change program? And these were some of the issues that we were seeing jurisdictions really just on the start of grappling with and not yet being able to address. We found probably only a very small number of minimum standards approaches in the world that were starting to take steps towards setting standards in this broader spectrum of perpetrator interventions. We also found a difference between approaches which looked at standards as mandatory, where there were consequences to program providers for not following standards, versus those that were more, I guess you could say, voluntary or advisory, where they were designed more to advise and form rather than taking the approach of providers who did not meet the minimum standards, for example, would no longer receive funding. We found a real lack of detailed practice guidance backing up minimum standards. There are some implementation guides. Victoria, for example, has an implementation guide backing its set of minimum standards. New South Wales has Towards Safe Families, which is now about 9 years old, which backed up its previous iteration of minimum standards. But we generally found a real lack of any of that more detailed documentation where of the extent of, say, 200 or 300 or 400 pages that really enable program providers to look at the range of different practice-based ways that they can meet the minimum standards. We wondered whether that might be a useful thing. Our jurisdictional scan revealed that some jurisdictions spend more effort than others or have more resources than others in trying to help program providers meet minimum standards. And when I talk about accreditation systems just in a couple of minutes, I'll focus on that then as well too. We found, for example, a Texas Council on Family Violence or Stopping Family Violence in WA or No to Violence in Victoria or Respect in the UK, like peak bodies that would, to the best extent that it can, given their funding, run training programs, professional development programs, communities of practice that helped program providers to try to comply with minimum standards. That was quite different from a number of other approaches where the funding body or the body that was administering standards was at a real arm's length from the providers, and there wasn't really a system of support to help providers to grapple with how to put minimum standards into practice in ways that make sense for their own local context. And funding is a really important issue here. We, in our jurisdictional scan, we did see examples of jurisdictions where minimum standards were set, but program providers, to be honest, did not have the funding coming from government to be able to put the standards into practice. And that's, in some jurisdictions, is a real tension. As minimum standards raise the bar in some ways and have increasing expectations to improve practice in particular ways, some of those ways we will focus on in the fourth part of today's webinar, that wasn't always accompanied by the resources which was necessary for program providers to stretch in the ways that new iterations of standards were asking them to stretch. We also found that on average in Australia, the length of time between setting minimum standards and the next update of minimum standards was actually about 11 and a half years. And this wasn't all that much different with overseas jurisdictions, with some exceptions. We wondered what that meant, and we found examples, for example, of minimum standards that were outdated that were still having an effect on practice, even though industry and best practice have moved away from that, where current state of knowledge was suggesting new ways of working that meant some of the ways of working in the existing minimum standards was no longer best practice, but it was still several years into the future before the next minimum standards would be updated. Compared to, for example, UK Respect or in Alberta, where rather than having a big standards update project every 10 or 11 years where everything gets shaken up and there's this massive consultation and process to update the standards, they do much smaller updates, updating little bits of it, say every 3 years ago, to try to keep some aspects of the minimum standards fresh according to growing practice and according to whatever research was being developed. So, you know, finally with accreditation systems. We, in our jurisdictional scan, we looked at a number of key principles guiding what could be considered effective accreditation processes. And I'll just put these up on the screen without going through them now, just really mindful of time. So these were some of the principles that were important to us. We didn't find many examples in the world of accreditation systems that were more than a bureaucratic tick and flick process. But those that were supported program providers, sometimes over a large number of months to become accreditation ready, provided accreditors with tools and templates that they could use to support accreditation, had accreditors that had some independence from the accrediting body, you know, et cetera, et cetera, and really went into it with a positive spirit of how could the accreditation process be part of like a community of practice to support program providers to put into practice the standards in more optimal ways. So we found a number of accreditation systems that were often just tick and flick, where the accreditor had quite a distance from the organisations that it were accrediting. We also found that when it was funding bodies who were checking compliance, the processes often did not work very well, that often funding bodies did not have the level of technical expertise or understanding of the service provision environment to be effective at monitoring compliance. We also found some differences at the level of accreditation systems. So UK Respect, for example, has increasingly been moving to accrediting organisations that provide perpetrator interventions. And that's in part because of that spirit of innovation that we've talked about earlier, that it wasn't only about accrediting individual programs, but more and more providers of men's behaviour change programs were also innovating, whether they were implementing a caring dads or doing men's family violence case management or focusing on new types of programs or interventions. So how can we be sure that that provider is a safe and appropriate organisation to run a range of different perpetrator interventions? So some accreditation systems move higher up. What are those things that a provider needs to provide to sustainably be able to provide effective and safe perpetrator interventions in the years ahead, rather than only looking at the program provider level. Nevertheless, comprehensive accreditation systems certainly provided some deep dives. And we found that common components were observing practice in the Texas Council on Family Violence, for example. The observations from practice are very frequent. It's every year. Looking at client files, staff files, et cetera, to cover off on a number of those minimum standards that are related here. But the informal check-ins were very important, that the support, opportunities for peer review of practice, that it wasn't just a formal mechanism conducted every 3 years, that there are other less time-consuming practices that were part of that comprehensive accreditation approach. Including, of course, a complaints mechanism. We also found a couple of examples of accreditation systems that were looking to accredit individual practitioners and not just programs, acknowledging the movement of practitioners between programs and acknowledging that in some jurisdictions, private practice work is an important part of the service mix. And as mentioned before, and you know, the last slide that I will show before handing over to questions, the supportive accreditation approach was a really important theme amongst some accreditation providers. The patient work to try to enable opportunities for providers to reach up, to have that capability lift, to have the community of practice. That wasn't the norm in what we saw. You know, most jurisdictions weren't providing that level of support. But where we did see it, we saw that the layers of support and layers of documentation often meant that program providers were supported for 6-9 months to a year before the actual accreditation process begins. So I'll move out of the slideshow now, and there's some space for questions on this part of our research. So just scanning to see if there's questions. I've got one question here, and that question is that given that minimum standards can persist for so long before they're updated, what do we see as some of the key changes to the standards that may not be reflected in some of the older standards documents? So I'll spend a minute or two talking about that while people think for other questions. I think if we look at some of the more recent updates to the minimum standards, say in Australia, like in Victoria, in New South Wales, I know that the Queensland standards are still currently in the final stages of finalisation, but also UK Respect and a few of those more recent updates in the US and also in New Zealand. Some of the themes that we found was a much stronger focus on elevating children's needs and experiences. Standards relating to stronger focus on assessing the impacts of family violence on children, even if only indirectly, of course, acknowledging that most program providers don't have direct contact with children. So we found that is quite a common theme. One or two of the newer iterations of standards, for example, focus on how do our child victim survivors become informed about the program that their father is doing? How do we start grappling with that? And again, not in a prescriptive way, but some of the new minimum standards put that there on the agenda. We're also seeing a stronger focus on increasing responsivity and tailoring programs, which will be a theme we'll be looking at later in this presentation too. One or two minimum standards explicitly focusing on the risk need responsivity model, for example, including how expectations for program providers to be more responsive to different cohorts of people who are using violence, but also too to take a more tailored approach depending on risk and need. So the latest New South Wales minimum standards, for example, don't have a minimum prescriptive length for men's behaviour change program work. Rather, the standard is that there needs to be an assessment done of what might be required to help to address the perpetrator's use of coercive, controlling and violent behaviour. And what does that then mean for length and intensity? The emphasis is more on the proper risk and need assessment rather than a minimum length. So we see a stronger focus on risk and need assessment. We're seeing a stronger focus on integrated practice, including trying to elevate support for partners as well. So in some of the latest minimum standards updates, an increased focus on if a victim survivor is already experiencing services from an existing specialist women's family violence service provider, could it be possible for partner contact to continue through the existing provider rather than transfer through to a partner contact men's behaviour change program provider so that she doesn't have to tell her story to someone else if she's already got trust with an existing worker. And I think the final, I guess, difference that we're seeing is a stronger focus on organisational requirements, probably more so in some of the overseas standards than here. But what are their supervision systems? What are their practice management systems? What's demonstrated in their relationships with specialist women's services providers or with police or courts and corrections? Do they have the sustainable staff policies to be able to ensure that new practitioners who come in are trained and supported properly? Do they have the ability to be able to provide services more generally in the organisation to a range of different cohorts and to start to look at maybe some of their own biases? So we're seeing that greater organisational focus. I might finish on that answer now hand over to the second part of our presentation that will be led by Donna.
I think I've just clicked on something I shouldn't have clicked on. So, apologies. Am I still up on the screen?
Yes, okay. You're good. All good now, Donna.
Thank you. Apologies for that. Let me just share that. Okay. So I was going to talk a little bit about women's perspectives in terms of the context of men's behaviour change programs. And I guess just following on from Rodney, one of the things is that whilst there are partner contact and women's perspectives involved in the UK, Europe and the Australian context, a lot of the American programs don't necessarily have partner contact. And in reviewing the standards around partner contact tend to be fairly descriptive, but not really intentional always in terms of what their goal is. So kind of focused on the what you're doing, but not the real intent of what you're doing. And as Rodney said, that's even made more complex when you're only looking at the particular type of one single group program. So with that in mind, these are some of the things that I think have come out of the research that we've done, as well as some recent research that we've just completed as well. And I guess the thing to say about women's perspectives is that this whole program area is unusual in that we don't usually have victim survivors' perspectives or partner perspectives on usual programs, either in the program content as part of the way the program's delivered, nor in the evaluation of the program. So in that sense, this sort of work is quite unusual and doesn't occur a lot in other types of interventions we do generally in human services. So it's unusual is in the first instance. As Rodney said about the sort of 11-year-old program standards, one of the things is it was first introduced as an idea of a sort of form of perpetrator accountability that the partner gave a perspective, etc. But as we know, given the dynamics of the way that family and domestic violence perpetration operates, it's also really important that we aren't relying on self-report, as people will know. So historically, the focus with women's partner contact has been on this area of sort of checking on safety and making sure women had referrals for support. What we know from the research about partner contact, which is quite limited, is that when women are when contact is made with partners via men's behaviour change programs, that those women usually have not had other forms of support available to them. So this is often the first sort of support that they're getting access to, which I think is really important, because there was often an assumption that those women, if they're not in contact with you as a program provider, they're not getting support, but in fact, our research tells us that often the partner contact was a first attempt at support for the woman. And I guess the other thing that we know about partner contact from practice all the time is that it's probably one of the most difficult areas in terms of it's highly labour-intensive work, and it's difficult to often make initial contact and retain contact with women partners, and particularly women ex-partners. And I guess particularly around men who may be court ordered, and there may be anywhere up to a sort of 8, 10, 12 week delay between the time at which the report came to the attention of authorities compared to when the man sort of has leaked fully first attendance a program. So that long delay is also contributes to why partner contact is difficult, as well as the fact that there's a group of women quite ethically and understandably say, look, I've lived with this person, it hasn't worked for me, I don't want to have anything more to do with him or what he does in his future, which makes perfect sense. But also women, just the nature of lives, trying to re-establish yourself also means that this becomes, can be quite a low priority amongst everything else. In contrast, the work in the Mirabelle Project in the UK, where the men were all attending the programs voluntarily, highlighted that women, and in some cases they tried to involve children, were quite active in their feedback and their involvement. So it really varies depending on the context. But what we do know is that there's a number of factors which contribute to this being difficult work and labour intensive just to make some initial contacts. Some of the limitations around why we don't have a lot of information about outcomes for women's perspective is that is consequently that small number of women that can be contacted in some programs. And then when you add research and evaluation to the end of that, that's even more difficult to often find those women and recruit women into studies, understandably. So we don't have a lot of women's voices in that longer term for research and evaluation. One of the things that's come up in a recent piece of work we're doing is that partner contact in some cases was linked or limited to the perpetrator participating in the men's behaviour change program. So that if he either withdrew from the program or he completed the program, that was directly linked to her access to partner contact and partner support. So for some women, that was kind of leveraged by men and held over their head as him being able to control the contact that she would have with her support, with services related to the MBCP. Obviously, if she's referred to other programs, that's different altogether. But this linking of her safety and support to his participation, whilst it was part of often a lot of contractual arrangements, it wasn't particularly helpful for women because it hung over their head that that would be the end of that contact. And for those women who were committed to wanting, like positively and negatively committed to wanting to let providers know how programs are going, it doesn't give providers that option either. So that might not be a large number of women, but there are women who did want to make sure that they let facilitators know what was happening in the longer term, and that opportunity is often cut off then. When we are trying to understand what impact men's behaviour change program outcomes have for women, often what has been used is a kind of a pre and a post measure, but often the measures that we've used have been very focused on the range of abusive behaviours and the severity of those behaviours. So we're looking at those, and we often measure those, whilst it's not the conflict tactics scale, we often measure those for like, has this happened? Has that happened? How often? We measure those in a way that doesn't capture the context when we sort of strip it back often. So often the workers' understanding of what's happening for the women, the partner contact worker and other workers, will be much more detailed and give us a much better understanding of safety and risk than what is often measured around chunking things down into behaviour measures. So whilst they're important, and we do need to know about things like the levels and the severity of different forms of violence and when there's stalking and those kind of things, we often don't have any context. So, for example, you know, isolating someone who lives on a farm is quite different to isolating someone who goes to work every day in the city but the rest of their social connectedness is cut off. So we don't have a lot of context, and context around women from culturally and linguistically diverse backgrounds who may belong to very small communities or in remote and regional areas where there may not be a lot of anonymity and privacy around what's happening, for example. So we don't often have the context, which is also really key to the story. So basically we don't have a lot of longer term data about the impact and the outcome because practically it's costly and it's really difficult to find and follow up with people over long periods of time. So we've got limited data there. And that is the kind of nature of the beast as it is. Methodologically, it's also difficult because what we often don't have, even with those limitations on numbers, is we don't have a good understanding always when we just measure behaviours about how the women's circumstances and the level of support women have both formally and informally, if they have informal support still around them. That also influences her sense of safety. And we don't have a good understanding necessarily about how that aligns to the types of violence and abuse used and their severity and whether they're changing. So that's really important to look at how those things influence her sense of safety, which her sense of safety will sometimes differ from her sense of fear. So she's, and often we treat fear and safety as if they're dichotomous, that you're either fearful or you feel safe, whereas we know from our work that particular circumstances and particular points in time, people's sense of fear increase. Like there might be a low level of fear that's escalated at points, and similarly, you might feel safe, but it doesn't mean you're still not fearful of what can occur. So I think we need to really dig down around what the programs are intending to do from women's perspectives, and also, like, and do they do that? Like, do they address the issues of kind of safety, and how would they go about reducing a woman's sense of fear? Because I think that we often collapse the two, and we still need to talk a lot about fear and not also about safety. And I think the other thing, as I've put there on the slide, is from a methodological point of view and from a practice point of view, looking at difference between women who are separated and women who are at that point continuing in the relationship, whatever form that might take, because I think the safety and the fear for those women are quite different things, but also what they are hoping for or wanting from a men's behaviour change program also might be different if they're going to be continuing in the relationship in some form, or even just that they have children so that they want to have some sense of what he's going to be like when there's fathering into the future. So what do we know from women so far? What we know is that where there is no MBC contact to offer any sort of alternative perspective, it can be used by the perpetrator to further abuse the woman, both as a minimising tactic in terms of I went there and there's all these other guys that aren't anywhere near as, aren't anything like me. I've had women report back that men have said to them, oh, I went to the group tonight, and basically at the group they told me that you're the problem and you're the one that needs to make the changes, etc. So without any of that being checked and having any sort of verification around it, women can actually be further kind of further abused and minimised what their complaints are, what their concerns are. So it can be used against women quite clearly, and has been in some situations, and it can also be used to further victim blame women. So we've heard a lot of women's reports where they talk about now that you've reported me and you've made a big deal of this situation, I'm in a group with criminals and it's all your fault and I'm nothing like that. And in fact, you should be quite grateful because compared to the blokes in the group, I'm nowhere near that bad. You're quite lucky and well off. So without any kind of filtering or any other verification, going to a men's behaviour change program can actually be really unhelpful for women in terms of further abuse, further put down. Where there is partner contact, reports from women do indicate that they feel safer being connected to that service provider and to that support and to knowing exactly what goes on in the group. So for women, just as the men, I guess, in lots of ways, this is the first kind of group intervention that people have any involvement with. They don't know what it involves. They don't know what can be expected around the change over the period of time, etc. So the importance of providing all that is really critical, as well as I've said before, the referrals to other support services, because what we're finding is women where the men are attending a program don't tend to have a lot of contact and support already in existence. I think the area that we know kind of changes early can be around reductions in physical violence for some groups of men, not for all men. But the coercive control we know less about, really. And it's partly a history of kind of measuring the different forms of violence that haven't included coercive control. So I think, again, thinking about how the program logic addresses coercive control with men and not just reduction of violence, etc., is a real challenge, given that the coercive control techniques and tactics have been developed over many years and are sort of deeply embedded within that person's modus operandi often. Women worry about the sustainability of any changes, which is not dissimilar to what workers worry about, I think. The other thing that I think is important that we haven't looked at, which some women have touched on, is the idea around hopefulness for change. And some women, as I've said, understandably think, well, your problem, your violence, you go and sort it out. For other women, they can pin a lot of hopefulness around the change. So the importance of service partner contact providing some sort of realistic gauge, and the workers supporting the woman outside of partner contact providing some gauge of what's likely and what's realistic is really important, because it impacts what women are experiencing and what they're expecting from the program, and it might be an over-expectation. Also, one of the things that women talked about a lot and comes up in the work that Susan Huard-Bell does as well is that men very rarely are showing any sort of insight into the impact of their abuse on the children. And for women, that's been a real concern that they don't see. Even if he hasn't if he's minimised the abuse against her, the fact that he is completely void of acknowledging any sort of impact of his behaviour on children is something they raise quite a lot. So in terms of moving forward, and we're going to pick up on this later in the webinar, so I won't talk a lot about it now, but the project Mirabelle has developed items which start to look at coercive control. Importantly, these items have been developed from the perspectives of women whose partners were attending a men's behaviour change program. So basically Project Mirabelle did a big evaluation of men's behaviour change programs in the UK, and some of what they came out with was how do we start to measure coercive control in its everyday actions? What does it look like in a kind of, the everyday mundane situation for people, and then moving to needing to create measures around that or develop measures. One of the things that they've done is talk about this notion of freedom in action. So the notion that women not just feel safe or don't fear being experienced violence, but they feel free to be able to go to work, meet with people, etc., like how they live their lives. And I think for me, in the work that we've done recently, some other projects, that's a really key thing, that women don't have a sense of freedom. They're still walking on eggshells, even if they feel less worried. So I think this is a really important area for development, both in the content of men's behaviour change programs, as well as in trying to look at women's experience of fear and safety and freedom of movement. For me, it's really important to that. Looking at the impact on parenting capacity is also an area for outcome development. And I know that other work around care and dads, etc., is starting to picks up on that quite directly. But I think some more acknowledgement of that work needs to occur in the context of outcomes. As Rodney picked up on earlier too, greater attention to diverse contexts and experiences. So, Aboriginal Torres Strait Islander people living in remote communities, how does the outcomes around supporting women and partner contact operate in that context? Because it's not just going to be a stock standard way. It's a very sort of metrocentric way of working, and it doesn't really fit that sort of broader model. Or cold women who are maybe remaining with partners and are in very small emerging communities have particular dynamic experiences. And I think the safety and accountability plans that we've talked about in this project, and we'll talk about some more, really offer some ways forward so that attendance at the MVCP isn't just the kind of end result and everybody goes back to business after that. So I see that as some sort of ongoing work that we'd really like to develop and change the context of how MVCPs have been seen in the past. Thanks. And I'll just turn off my slide share now. Okay, and I'm not sure if I've got any questions, so I'll just scroll along. Sorry, I just had a phone call there. Okay, so I'll hand over now to Andrew because I think we're running close to time and I'll come back to that at the end.
Okay, thanks Donna and thanks Rodney. I think the technology is working okay. Thanks also to Paul and Speak for putting this webinar together. It's very nice to have the opportunity to talk to people about this work, which was finished last year, but I think still has currency as things are moving very quickly in this area, both over the duration of our project and since our project report was published. I've got 5 or 10 minutes to talk about some broad issues around evaluation. And it really picks up on a few things that have already been raised by both Rodney and Donna. And I guess there won't be any surprises here for anyone that works in the field. For me, one of the most important and interesting things that emerged from our work was the discussions that arose about the extent to which programme standards are supported by evidence. Or to put this another way, whether there's enough evidence to show that actually complying with a particular standard will result in improvements to the safety of women and children. And as Rodney mentioned, the evidence is often absent or only partially present. And so in many ways, it became very clear to us from an early stage of the project that the development of practice standards can't be separated from what we know about programme evaluation and how to identify features of programmes that are most effective in bringing about change. And I think as everyone here will know, the effectiveness of men's behaviour change programmes is something that's been fiercely contested over many years now. And I don't want to go into the various debates that are important to taking a position on this. But what I would say is that in 2015, ANROWS published an account of the current state of knowledge, which concluded that overall programmes produce mixed results and that even when a programme can be shown to reduce further violence against women, the effects are usually small. The literature review that we did last year also concluded that there's no consistent evidence to suggest that any one type of programme is likely to be more effective than any other. And really our conclusion was that the current evidence base is simply not robust enough to support any detailed prescriptions about what might constitute best practice in the area. And so I guess this is why Rodney was talking about standards that can support practice rather than standards that are focused on compliance with fixed rules around what people can and can't do within their intervention regimes. We're also kind of, I think, very aware of the concerns that were expressed that providers generally didn't have the funding, the resources or the methodological expertise to routinely and systematically collect the type of process, impact and outcome data that they need to establish process program effectiveness. In fact, many of the providers that we've spoken to talk about the tension between needing to put scarce resources into strengthening the quality of program delivery itself or into program evaluation. And they argue that it's impossible to do both of these things well. We also know that evaluation practice and outcome measurement varies considerably in practice, with different providers using a range of different assessment tools and approaches. So when we started this project, our intention was to conduct a national controlled evaluation of program outcomes across a number of different programs around the country. soon became clear that this wouldn't be possible within the funding we had from ANROADS. And so we changed our focus to think more about what we called evaluation readiness. So this is the sorts of things that we all need to take into account if we're to be in a position to meaningfully evaluate change in our programmes. So today I wanted to talk about one particular part of this and one type of evaluation, how we might go about establishing whether a particular person has changed over the course of attending a programme, and what we might need to know to make reliable judgments about this. Of course, knowing whether or not someone's likely to continue to act violently is crucial to every aspect of our work and something that every practitioner and agency should be thinking about on a daily basis. The starting point for us was to make the point that we need to be very clear about what it is we're trying to change and how we might expect the actual activities that we run in programmes to contribute to both short and longer term goals. And for me, this means we have to be clear about our underpinning programme theory. And by this, I'm not talking about theories of why men act violently in relationships, but theories of how people change their behaviour. And there's a large body of knowledge about this, based on how people change all sorts of different problem behaviours that we became interested in and thought about in the process of completing this project. This slide and the next one summarises some of the key interventions that cut across all types of different behaviour change programmes. For example, if we provide information about ongoing risk and the consequences of the behaviour, as well as information about the perspectives of others, then behaviour change is more likely to follow. If we offer consistent encouragement to change, set behavioural tasks that get progressively more challenging and provide clear instruction and modelling of what we're looking for, then people are also more likely to change their behaviour. And so to me, these are all things that good facilitators do naturally, but I think it is useful to think about those areas that we devote the most time to, as well as those that might be neglected if we want to maximise the effectiveness of our work. So the key point here, though, is that if we work from a theory of how behaviour actually changes, then we can design and deliver activities that can be reasonably expected to work. And this is something that doesn't always happen when people design programmes, and it makes evaluation much more difficult. Related to the idea of having a clear programme theory is the notion of programme logic, which helps us to explain, I guess, in more detail or in concrete terms about how taking part in a programme might logically be related to the outcomes and goals that we're seeking to achieve. So programme logic models are often used to describe this process, and I think are very useful in describing what we think the short-term outputs and outcomes of programme participation should be, and then how these might build to result in a longer-term outcome that we often assess in programme evaluation work. And so it's the shorter-term outcomes that we should be assessing when we're thinking about the extent to which someone has changed. And I say this because, in our view, a focus on the short-term outcomes focuses our attention as much on the more specific signs of change that we're looking for by the end of a programme, and much more helpful than only thinking about longer-term outcomes such as single incidents of reoffending. We tend to think about violence as occurring within a broader pattern of coercive control, and it's evidence that this is reduced that we should look for by the time that someone comes to complete the programme. We also talk a lot about how domestic and family violence is often the product of a developmental process where particular attitudes, beliefs, values, emotional regulation styles and behaviours have really been built up for many years. And now it's often unrealistic to expect participation in an 18 or 24 week group programme to completely change these. So if we think about how we might assess change in the short term, and these are some of the approaches that we identified and became interested in. From probably the most obvious of these is to look for evidence for a reduction in the level of risk at the end of a programme. Although most risk assessment tools have been designed to simply classify people rather than to assess change over time. In my view, assessing risk reliably is something that's far from straightforward, and there's currently not much evidence that reductions in violence risk assessment tool scores actually translate into the reduced rates of violence. And there was a question earlier, I think, about the risk needs model that we might return to later if we've got time to discuss that. What it means for me is that we also need to think about other approaches and a range of other instruments and methodologies that have been developed that can be useful in assessing change at the end of a programme. One that I particularly liked, and Rodney saw some information about, was a tool called the BIPOS, a tool from Colorado in America, that talks about five key areas where we might expect or want change to occur. So with the BIPOS, program participants are asked to rate a series of questions that reflect each of these areas, and the scores can then be used to inform judgments of their progress at the end of the program. These are just some of the questions that they use, but it's easy to see how the answers to these questions might give us a sense of how far someone's progressed. And Donna was talking about Project Mirabel in the UK. And as she said, this was an important project because it developed a set of questions for partners to answer that were derived from partners' experience of men being in programs. And one of the most important observations, and I think Donna made this point as well, here is that we shouldn't rely solely on the self-report of perpetrators, as there's obvious reasons why these might reflect an attempt to impression manage, particularly when people aren't attending programs on a voluntary basis. And so asking partners for their views on whether someone's changed seems critical to us, and yet this still isn't something that necessarily happens routinely. But these are some of the questions from the Mirabel project that I think are interesting and potentially worthwhile asking. Going through very quickly, one of the other things we can do is to monitor how someone is after every session that he attends, and there's a number of different approaches to doing this. This is an example from the New South Wales department, which encourages program providers to monitor progress on a session-by-session basis. And again, just thinking about each of these areas and how each person presents in a group on a week-to-week basis is informative in its own right. So these are just some examples of how we've been thinking about the best way to judge the extent to which someone's changed, and none of them are perfect. And we do need to find a way to distill the best features of these different approaches and find a way to make it viable to collect the best information that we can to assess change. In terms of the role that evaluation of change has to play in the development of program standards, I think we'd like to see greater standardisation across the sector so that we can start to aggregate data both within programs over time and between different programs. However, I do think that the first step is to go back and think very carefully as a community of practice about how we make judgments of whether or not someone's safe at the end of a program. There's probably been too much emphasis placed in contracts on program attendance and completion without enough thought put into the behaviour change process. And while there's good reasons for this, we hope that some of this material is useful for us to think about and try and develop into some way of improving practice in this area. I think it also raises some important questions about what we should do when we believe that someone hasn't changed sufficiently for us to be confident that partners and children are no longer at risk, as well as how we might go about improving the accuracy of our risk assessments and making sure that we corroborate self-report data with that of potential victims. The idea that violence follows patterns that develop over the course of a lifetime also suggests, I think, to us that expecting a relatively brief intervention to lead to long-term behavioural change may not be realistic, and we do need to move our focus along to the shorter-term changes and the risk management processes that might follow programme attendance. And so we concluded our report, I guess, with the suggestion, and Rodney will talk about this in the final section, that the primary outcome of programme attendance should probably be a coherent understanding of violence and how it might stop, and documenting this in a way that can be shared between key stakeholders. We talk about this in terms of safety and accountability planning, and I think I've come to the view that the result of attending a men's behaviour change programme should be the development of a very clear, strong and robust safety and accountability plan. But let me finish this section on evaluation here and just open it up for to see if there's any questions. Okay, so Donna, you've asked a question, or you made a comment there. Did you want to make a comment about that? Sorry, Paul, we'll just have to unmute you. There you are, you're on.
Thanks. For me, I think they're really important because I think it is that future focus as well, that it's not resolved within the time, but also I think the importance of stressing the continuing accountability back to others is really important from my point of view as well. But as you say, Andy, I think what's really key is that they're robust and that there's some sort of way of checking in and following up with them as well. Otherwise, they sort of can become potentially symbolic if there's not an ongoing commitment in some way to them.
Thanks, Donna. I mean, I'm very aware that people want simple, quick, cheap easy solutions to some of these questions, and our works largely failed to deliver those, actually. And I think it's kind of inevitable, really. These are very kind of complex questions that sound simple. I mean, people want to know answers to simple questions like, does the program work? Is my partner safe? What more needs to be done after someone completes the program? And I guess it's been an interesting project for us because we've brought together Donna, Damien, Rodney, and I have different perspectives and different backgrounds coming into this area. And part of that has really shown to us just how complicated this is to develop anything that can be easily implemented. And also for me, just the constraints that are placed on program providers to do anything more than meet the basic contracts and deliver the very basics of getting people along to programs and fulfilling a minimum standard. Whereas I guess from my hope is that we can be more aspirational there and start thinking now about the best quality and the most effective programs that we can deliver rather than simply ensuring that people attend programs. Just quickly before we finish, a comment about risk needs responsivity models. So, I mean, my background has been largely within correctional. And this is a model of practice that's really dominated correctional services for the last 15 or 20 years across Australia. And I've been very interested to see it's beginning to be imported into the men's behaviour change sector over maybe the last 4 or 5 years. I think we need to be very cautious about this. I mean, again, the risk needs responsivity model offers a simplicity that is very appealing to policymakers, instills some confidence that there's this kind of framework of case management that sits around practice. But ultimately, it rests on the validity of the risk assessment tools that we use, and that requires a lengthy program of research to establish their predicted validity with the local populations in which we work. And one of the things that I've worked on over the last couple of years are some of the problems with applying a risk-based approach to working with members of Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander communities. And certainly many of the things that we've spoken about in our report and thinking about change, I think, aren't cultural approaches in terms of assessing the impact on communities or on extended families. And that's clearly an area where a lot more thought is needed. We kind of stayed away from that in our project because ANROADS has funded another round of kind of projects that are looking explicitly at that item. But it is something I think that's a limitation of our work. We've adopted a model of individual change and looking at how the individual changes at the end of the program rather than something more systemic of how that impacts both on family members more broadly, including what lateral violence means in terms of these programs. And communities more generally. But I might finish there if there's no other questions. The slides will be available. Someone's made a comment about some of the headings that people assess. The slides will be available after the webinar's finished, but they're also kind of reproduced in our full report, which is available from the ANROADS website. So I'll leave it there and then hand back to Rodney, who can talk about accountability plan.
Thanks. Great. Thanks, Andy, and thanks, Donna. I'll conclude with probably about 10 minutes or so looking at some of the implications for practice, including safety and accountability planning, and then we'll have some final more time for questions. So I'll put my slides up. Okay. So, following on from Andy's comment about the risk need responsivity model, I think there's been a lot of focus, a lot of roads leading towards how do we tailor our interventions with people who cause family violence harm rather than some people would say throwing the same intervention at all of the men and hoping that something would stick. I think it's a very unfair criticism of our work. I think we've always been trying to tailor our work the best that we can. However, we have been so limited by funding, by resources, by the ability to have that time to think separately about each of the men in the program and what that might mean. I think there's greater calls for doing that now, and it's been a little bit of time now focusing on what that might mean, including safety and accountability planning, which we focused a lot on when we're trying to pull together the different pieces of our research. So we've talked about R&R, obviously not rock and roll, but the risk-need-responsivity model. And I think, as Andy was saying, it's quite aspirational in some ways. We don't yet have the risk assessment tools to enable us to be able to reliably differentiate people who cause family violence harm into, say, low, medium and high risk categories. Because that often requires a number of different sources of information to come together. It requires sophisticated and nuanced understanding about the perpetrator's different dynamic risk factors, the needs that he has, and how those needs like AOD and mental health relate to the more central gender-based factors that are driving his use of violence. We don't really have the sophisticated family violence-informed risk assessment tools yet to be able to safely differentiate a man as a low-risk offender. And while there are tools to be able to differentiate perpetrators more generally in terms of criminal behaviours, low, medium and high risk of more general criminal offending, we don't yet have the research that shows predictive validity for people who cause family violence harm. That doesn't mean that we can't and that we don't have indicators or some tools that we can draw upon to help to differentiate those who are high risk, higher harm perpetrators. What it does mean is that we're at really great danger of trying to isolate men who we think are at low risk and getting that wrong. And some of those men posing a higher risk than what they really might first seem. So what does tailoring interventions in practice mean? Well, it can mean a number of things. And I'll just, you know, quickly fly through some things that we're already very mindful of and trying to do to a greater or lesser extent in our practice, depending on what the resources allow. More time for initial and ongoing assessment is obviously a really important part of that. Sometimes we may not get that sense of coercive controlling behaviours. We may not get that sense of the depth of his victim stance narratives or the extent of possessive jealousy, etc., until he's a third of the way through the program. At that point, his partner might feel safer telling us more about his patterns of coercive control. We've had some time to observe more of his thinking, etc., underneath that. So tailoring means how do we keep that assessment practice alive and understand that the initial one-to-one sessions with him, maybe they're more initial intake rather than comprehensive assessment. It's that time to strengthen program readiness and capacity to participate. For program providers who receive referrals of men who start off with a very low motivation base or who have very messy lives or AOD and mental health problems, which might narrow some of the space they have to focus on interventions to help them to be safer men to be around. That work might mean obviously not throwing him so much into a group or having more one-to-one sessions or doing some case management. And I think some other research that I've been involved in, and I'll just quickly tie in really, really quickly here, shows that it's not necessarily so much a case of there's some men who will need X amount of case management in period A before they can then start the men's behaviour change program work. Often that readiness work is about slowly, gradually building that capacity for men's behaviour change program working. And that work can start really early on, almost from day one for many of the men, but it might be a small window, and the work around his other needs is about gradually building that window. That doesn't mean that you leave that work until his AOD or mental health problems have totally been addressed. You know, case planning, how does a range of different dynamic risk factors all relate to each other? If a man is abusing substances, how does that substance use relate to the choices he's making to use violence? Is he deliberately using substances to make her afraid? Is he trying to make her dependent on substances? Was there a pre-existing substance use issue that he used to cope with particular experiences that he's had? So there are very different ways in which a dynamic risk factor can relate to the choices he's making to use violence and his patterns of coercive control. The case planning means teasing that out for each individual perpetrator. How do these risk factors relate for him in a way that might not exactly be the same for others? And that has implications for how we go about addressing them. Case reviews, including when men have been referred by child protection or corrections, courts, integrated family support services. How do we maintain that joined up approach so that the man is not just left with a men's behaviour change program provider? We've talked about, you know, case management, something that I know many program providers would love to do but don't often have the resources to. The use of a greater number of individual sessions in a range of different ways through the program, more time at the beginning, more exit sessions, etc. And that while, because we don't have that sophisticated capacity to be able to stream family violence perpetrators into, you know, low, medium and high risk interventions that have very, very different natures, we still can, when we're identifying those men who are high risk, higher harm perpetrators or who have more complexity in their dynamic risk factors. Maybe they need another group work module, more individual sessions, more time spent on trying to assess and address how they might be sabotaging his partner's parenting. Doesn't necessarily mean NBCP Light, NBCP and NBCP Deluxe, three different groups. It might, however, mean some variation in how we go about weaving together individual and group work sessions. And finally, safety and accountability planning, which we'll be focusing on for the rest of this time. As we know, however, there are barriers to tailoring. Many program providers, we don't have the resources to be able to do that well. Sometimes it's about skills. It's about skill worker. It's about individual worker skill to be able to do some of those assessments and not having the tools to support us. And sometimes about program philosophy and the contractual environment. You know, often we're contracted to deliver a program to men. We're not so much contracted to provide a flexible program that's responsive to risk. That might look a bit differently from one man to the other if we're trying to vary the program to focus on what are those risks that his partner and children are currently facing and what does that mean for how we weave together individual and group work sessions. And so just briefly, when we're trying to tease out some of these issues with focus groups of both community-based and corrections practitioners in Western Australia, South Australia and Victoria, we found a few different themes, which I'm just going to relate to now so that we can spend a couple of minutes on safety and accountability planning and then have time for more questions. Commonalities of practitioners managing men with very low readiness to change, where there hadn't yet been that sense of collective responsibility and that engagement by other non-specialist services in the service system to try to inch them a little bit forward in developing a bit of an internal motivation for change. We've mentioned before that we don't have the wide assessment tools yet to be able to tailor programs as well as we would like to. I think some of the work that Andrew is talking about is that how do we start to think about what are those signposts for change that we might observe in men's behaviour in the program or might hear through partner contact, maybe focus them in our individual case planning. And there are a couple of jurisdictions that talk about them as competencies in a way. Many program providers are still struggling with low rates of partner contact for various reasons that make it difficult to provide those windows into whether he's changing or not. We saw program providers and practitioners trying the best they can to do a bit of individual safety and accountability planning, which we'll close on in a minute. And the difference between the ideal of wanting to have a joined up collaborative integrated service system where there are other agencies that are supporting his participation through the program, and the reality is often quite huge, unfortunately, where men's behaviour change program providers and referrers aren't working together as closely as we would like for all of the reasons that we unfortunately know about. So finally, in safety and accountability planning. For us, safety and accountability planning is more than an exit plan. in the sense that, you know, many program providers currently do exit planning with men and may have a session, individual session at the end. But it's more than that. We were focusing on building it throughout the program, steps along the way where the men might progressively, gradually build their safety and accountability plan, acknowledging that what they start off with in the intake assessment sessions or what they might do after the first group work module might be very tiny compared to where they'd eventually get to. But it's something that we focused on building throughout the program. The process of developing it, almost as important as a product. The process of engaging him with some individual time around being able to thicken the goals that he sets for himself as he goes along, to talk more about those sore points where he knows that he might be at risk of using violence, to be able to gradually identify some of those influences in his life that will hold him back from being a safer man to be around, the process of engaging him throughout the program. And that while it can start in the initial assessment phase, we can also harness the involvement of the group, potential for men to present interim plans to group members and get feedback in the group, et cetera, et cetera. It requires some use of individual sessions weaved in, even if it's only one individual session here and there. After a session or two, looking at impacts of men's use of violence on children and how respecting his partner, parenting capacity, is it a critical part of him being a father? Maybe an individual session to give him some time to turn some of that into intent and commitments as part of a safety and accountability plan. And extending an exit process beyond maybe just that one session. So something has occurred throughout the program. We also saw it as more than a personal private plan as well too, that this could be a plan that's shared with his partner, possibly with others who might have a stake about whether he becomes a safer man to be around. Maybe they have the right to be able to see this plan and what he says that he's committed to changing. Maybe sharing with corrections or police or our courts, if they've got some sort of an ongoing stake in assessing his risk, providing it to referrers so that the system has a copy of the plan rather than it being his own private plan. And then finally, that the plan could be more than a piece of paper. It's not a document, a case file, case formulation. It's something that's more for him. It could be creative. It could involve creative means. It might be something that he uses his phone or creates videos for or artwork, etc. It's not necessarily something that's just written. As we talked about before, the active involvement of a man is critical in this plan rather than it's just something that's done for him. You know, some men will need more support and scaffolding than others to develop the plan, and in a way that takes into account his preferred learning styles and information processing, and using media that will be relevant for him. So we've flown through a bit about safety and accountability planning, which was a major part, which was a major conclusion that we draw from our research. I think we'll now throw back to see if there are time for questions on any part of our research. So you can also remember you can raise your hand as well as using the chat function. If you've got questions that you would like to ask, you could use the raise your hand function as well too, so that you can actually speak a question too. So just as, you know, while people are thinking, we've got one question here regarding funding implications of tailoring. And maybe Andy and Donna, I don't know if you've got some particular thoughts around if we were to tailor programs more, what might be the funding implications in terms of unit costs more broadly? Do you have any thoughts or ideas based on your experience? I think, Donna, you're on mute.
Yes, yeah, sorry, Rodney, because Paul's controlling the muting and unmuting. I mean, I think that is one of the issues, is around the funding and how the funding is organised, and also the detail. So there's the funding, but there's also the specifications in the contract. And I guess in our work over the years, we've seen some that are highly specified and some less specific in what they say. So I think that, you know, it needs goodwill on the part of policy and program central office contracting people to have those, to sort of be more aware about what we need in the what's needed in the field, and also how those additional things that we're requesting that we trial or we pilot can make a difference in terms of the tailoring, given that they're really well aware that we need to be able to tailor programs, and this provides one way of doing it, which is not about having sort of 50 or 60 different programs for different types of men with different issues.
Just a quick comment about evaluation funding. I mean, it's normal these days for 20% of a program budget to be put aside for evaluation, and I don't think that happens very much in this sector, and that would be an extraordinary resource that people could use. But my observation is that we don't need a series of low quality, methodologically weak evaluations. We don't need hundreds of evaluations that are essentially telling us very little or what we already know, springing up all over the place, because it's not the type of evidence that policymakers need to make decisions about which programs they want to roll out or implement or fund more systemically. And so there is kind of an argument for funding for larger scale, cross-jurisdictional, cross-provider kind of research. But we've got to have, I think, a rigor and a consistency of practice. So we've got to do the process evaluation, if you like, before we start moving on to outcome, impact and outcome evaluation.
And so one of the most important issues for funding bodies to think about is how to best support practitioners to make better assessments of the extent to which every individual who's attended a programme has changed, and importantly, the extent to which these changes will give us sufficient confidence to reasonably expect that their partners and children will be safe moving forward.
Yes, I might just briefly add before really handing back over to Paul to close the webinar, because I'm just aware of time, that, I think they're both, you know, extremely important perspectives into this. How much additional funding is needed to tailor program providers depends upon the base. But if we look at some men who have a significant cursor controlling behaviours, you know, it's like what you're saying, Andrew, is that to start to make a dent in some of those cursor controlling behaviours and to address some of the needs, Donna, that you're talking about, of adult and child victim survivors, you know, some of these men will need intervention string together over 6, 8, 10, 12 months. Others will only need 3 months, but it doesn't take too many moderate to moderate high risk, high harm perpetrators within an overall cohort for the costs to need to come up. There could be 60, 80, 100 hours of intervention needed for some of these men, and that comes from the corrections literature. So there are some cost implications for this, absolutely. Paul, I'm aware that we've run out of time, so I might now hand back to you to close the webinar.
Thank you, Rodney. Thank you, Andrew, and thank you, Donna. There's really quite a wealth of information in everything that's been presented there. So thank you for spending the time telling us about that. There is going to be a discussion forum for speaker members on the website if you'd like to continue with any further follow-up questions. And all of the resources related to this event will also be available. It's really important for us, because this is our very first webinar, that you fill out a survey, feedback survey for us. There was supposed to be an email go out, but I'm not sure if it actually did what it was supposed to. So there is a link there that will take you to the resources and the survey, which is pic.org.au/webinar. Thank you all for being part of it, and we look forward to catching up with you at some later stage. Thank you. Okay.